Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Building Deeper Green with Bill Reed and John Becker. And as you know, we've been working down through the essentials of what it means to be sustainable or what the issues we need to be addressing to truly achieve a sustainable condition on the planet. And today, we are working and meeting with Marcus Scheffer, a very well-known energy engineer, energy modeler, and daylighting designer. And he'll be on in a few minutes. But to get us into that, John, do you want to set us up a little bit?
I have one question. Is sustainability really all about energy?
Boy, that's what they seem to be saying out there. I get introduced sometimes when I'm speaking as Bill Reed is going to talk about energy sustainability. And I have to actually spend the first 5 minutes of a talk telling people that energy is not necessarily sustainable, and if we're talking about sustainability, energy is certainly a very important aspect, but it's not the whole enchilada.
Okay, so is it about efficiency?
That, for sure.
Well, is it about efficiency? Because one of our partners, this is really an interesting conversation. You know, this we might need to have a two or three bottle of wine conversation about this. Maybe.
No doubt.
We have become really efficient at being inefficient, right? So we're so inefficient with how we do things, we've become more efficient at doing them inefficiently.
Right? Yeah, let's unpack that one a little bit, right?
All right, right.
So think about
the design process we have, yeah?
Okay.
Right? And think about how we select our mechanical systems for a given building.
All right, well, let's walk through. That's a great scenario. Let's walk through that.
Right.
So I'm an architect, assembling a design team. The client wants to create an energy-efficient building, a LEED Gold building, let's say, and it's got to be energy-efficient up to some level. What's the first thing we do?
Under normal circumstances
Under normal circumstances, conventional circumstances.
Conventional circumstances, well, we probably go hire, try to find an architect and an engineer who have some experience with LEED projects. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
And the first thing that will probably happen is the architect will come up with a sketch of what the building looks like.
Right, because you got to start with something, right?
Yeah, and it's sort of that linear process that the architect is solving the form of the building and then sending that off to all the different engineers. So the mechanical engineer gets the drawing, and there's what the shape of the building is, right?
And the shape of the building is a given, and so the mechanical engineer, so let's imagine a scenario. There's a view to the west. And the architect wants to, and the client want to emphasize that view. So they have a whole window wall of glass facing the west. And the energy engineer has to, or the mechanical engineer has to come up with an incredible amount of air conditioning to make the building quote unquote work.
And in addition to that, not have any input on what that envelope, thermal envelope of that building is. And on top of that, it's probably going to try and find, bless his or her little heart, the most efficient HVAC system, heating and cooling system, ventilating that they can come up with.
Okay,
right?
so let's talk about that scenario. The mechanical engineer has no input on the envelope because that's the architect's domain, no input on the view and orientation of the building because that's the architect's domain. So all, in fact, they're rarely invited into the design process until the architect has actually designed the building.
Well, it gets worse, right? You have another player hanging out over here who's divorced from both of those guys whose responsibility it is to design the lighting, right? And generally speaking, they might want to target, maybe 60 to 50 foot candles in a given office space, which is about double what you need, but those are likely what they were taught in school and conditioned by virtue of certain standards and rules of thumb to design to.
And litigation.
So those lights are going to produce a lot of heat. In addition to all that heat coming in that western window, and even if you're in a northern climate, you have now a whole bunch of heat you have to deal with, right? So what we've done is, the reason why that scenario is efficient is because everybody knows their job. The architect.
Well, it makes a cost. It makes it so that you can price a building in advance. You can price the design of a building that's never been designed, so that everybody knows their job in a way that, well, everybody knows their job under the conventional practice that allows you to price the building, and therefore everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Except that we're not.
Except for generally, what happens is that the size of that heating and cooling system ends up being probably, more often than not, double what it actually needs to be.
Well, not only more. I can tell you that in the survey that we did on large office buildings in the mid-90s in Washington, D.C., 100% of the 10 or 12 buildings, I forget how many, we looked at were literally double the capacity. In fact, the facilities people said, we've never turned on half of the capacity that we had built into the building. So they literally spent $500,000 to $1.5 million more for air conditioning equipment that wasn't needed.
Okay, so now let's drop this down a notch. What happens if I go in my house and I say, all right, I want to replace all my lights with LEDs?
Right? Okay, very efficient.
Right? Well, let's back off that a minute. And just tonight, walk around. Here, this is an experiment that's worth trying. Tonight, turn off all the lights in your house and walk around and see if you can see.
Yeah.
Particularly in your kitchen.
Especially if you're in an urban area.
Well, what I mean is all the sort of LED lights that are on your microwave clock and your coffee maker timer and the oven clock, all of the sort of little things that are sucking up energy. I mean, literally,
clock, radio, toothbrush, they're like navigation buoys.
That's right. yeah. But you know, they help. You know, bang your face into the wall, right? Because you have the light off, but. In some ways, we can see that we're using energy like water. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, since we just talked about water, that's actually kind of interesting.
That's pretty interesting. So
we treat energy as this continuous flow, just like we treat water as this continuous flow. And so we do. I think about this. I just flick on a light switch. But because it's a continuous flow from the powers from the electrical grid. Yet, if I was dependent on batteries in my house to turn on those switches, I would not be turning on many switches.
Yep. And so now what we have, though, is a really interesting time in that suddenly we're all hearing about issues about climate change. Heavens, we even have at the federal government level a cap-and-trade program that is being brought historically for the first time into our political discussion.
Fine.
So what that does is that sort of introduces a door that we can ask Marcus to come through and talk to us a little bit about what's the difference between really working towards a systemic solution and, let's just say, being energy efficient. So maybe that's a good way.
Good one. That's a good one. And we're talking about integration. So integrate. How do we actually develop an integrated system of thinking about not only doing energy design, but thinking about it?
So let me just say real quickly that Marcus is a partner in a company called Seven Group. They're green building consultants, as am I. And we met, 14 years ago, 15 years ago?
Thereabouts.
Somewhere in there. Anyway, Marcus has been working on the energy components and inputs of buildings now for at least 20 years. So, Marcus, with that said, tell us what you think about the way to approach these issues systemically as opposed to, let's say, being really
linear,
energy efficient.
Well, the way I view sustainability is it's not necessarily the end game, right? It's not necessarily a target that we put up on the wall and we're trying to shoot for that, because I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what that is and exactly what that looks like. I view it more as a continual process, right? And so you never really, I don't think, or we're never going to really achieve total sustainability in many respects, especially given the state of the world right now.
You mean total efficiency, Marcus, is that right?
No, I mean total sustainability.
Well, then we're in trouble.
Well, can you get it to the point where you can move beyond it, right? I'm not sure we know what even sustainability looks like, but clearly we need to move beyond that.
Well, then let me just interject, though. That's really why half the program that we're talking about how do we work with living systems, not just technical systems.
Exactly. Okay. So I view, getting back to the issue of efficiency, efficiency is a mechanism I see to help us head in that direction. So let's suppose that somebody were to define a sustainable energy system as using all renewable sources, right? So you're using solar and you're using wind and, you know, maybe water and tidal energy to a certain extent and the usual renewable kind of energy sources that we're hopefully heading toward. Efficiency, to me, is really this significant bridge that's going to allow us to get there much quicker. So you can implement all kinds of energy efficiency strategies, and the opportunities are just unbelievably enormous. So I think you guys have seen this visual image I show, which shows all the sources of energy and all their uses and how much is actually comes out the other end in useful work versus how much of it's wasted.
Well, describe that, would you? Would you talk about that from a percentage perspective?
You mean how much is wasted?
Yeah.
It's more than we use. Probably about, trying to remember the numbers, 30-40% more than we use.
So what you're saying is if we burn gas, natural gas or coal or oil in a power plant, after we use the energy to get that energy to the power plant in the first place, and it gets transmitted over the lines, what's the percentage reduction?
Right. There's two big sources there. And the one you're describing is the production of electricity, which is somewhere around 30-33% efficient. So the BTU in the coal versus the BTU of useful work you get out of it. Is about 30% efficient. The other big one, which is even less efficient, is the internal combustion engine. So while that obviously is a big part of our problem, the way I like to look at it is we're the Saudi Arabia of energy efficiency opportunities here. We could, I mean, there are so many things, there's so much low-hanging fruit that we could implement in extremely cost-effective manners within our current economic system. You know, a lot of folks postulate that if we really got serious about this, we could approach a factor 10 reduction in energy consumption. We're that wasteful.
So what are the? You know, we heard the past administration talk about that conservation is a personal virtue, and now here you're saying the opposite. Of course, we believe that. But what are those things, just to help the audience know what...
what are those efficiency
besides changing
strategies?
Light bulbs. I mean, that's one of them, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, so if you focus on the two biggest wasters of energy, is producing our electricity more efficiently, and typically that's going to be, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've been hearing about in the news. Smart grids, more small-scale distributed power sources. You know, give you a quick example. One of the line losses you mentioned, Bill, are one component. I think that's something like 10%. But the majority of losses are actually wasted heat, right? So they put power plants by rivers and bodies of water for a reason. They need some place to dump all that waste heat. And that's why you see cooling towers at nuclear power plants, so on and so forth. They're getting rid of waste heat.
Yeah,
and if
like
we could somehow capture the waste heat from the production of electricity, that can take the efficiency of that process from about 30-33% up to something like 70-75%. I remember I used to work for the State Energy Office in Pennsylvania, and there was a study that I remember reading years ago. Somebody looked at all the power plants in Pennsylvania and calculated that if we were to capture the waste heat from those power plants and put it into greenhouses, Pennsylvania could become a net exporter of food.
Wow.
Easily.
Perfect place to take a break. Hold that thought, and we'll be right back on Building Deeper Green. See you all in a minute.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at SkillsUSA.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Today we're chatting with Marcus Scheffer, energy expert, I think I could call him, from Seven Group, and he just gave us a very interesting statistic. Marcus, could you repeat that for us, please?
Well, I used to work for the State Energy Office of Pennsylvania, and years ago I remember seeing a study that someone calculated that if all the power plants in Pennsylvania were to actually utilize their waste heat and dump it into greenhouses, that Pennsylvania could very easily and then some become a net exporter of food. So the biggest problem with our electrical production, somewhat the line losses, but it's all that heat that we just dissipate into the environment one way or another.
So you were talking then about this. I mean, that's another means of increasing efficiency is capturing all that waste heat.
Right. Where I was headed earlier was just trying to rethink our electrical system.
Yeah.
You know, smart grid, distributed, localized distribution and generation of power. As opposed to the kind of old utility mentality of real men build power plants, bigger the better, big transmission lines, and then we wheel it all over the place.
So are we getting there? Marcus, is the utility industry beginning to think more systemically now?
I think somewhat. I think there are certain segments within the utility industry that are starting to think that way. If you look at the orders for power plants, over the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Certainly the orders for power plants, right, there haven't been any new nuclear plants ordered in quite a long time. There's been a lot of opposition to a whole bunch of new coal plants. So I think we're seeing growing public opposition to the older mentality, and I think we're going to see a lot of incentives at the federal level. There have been a lot of changes in the utility industry and the development of rate structures, this whole concept of megawatts, actually allowing utilities to earn revenue from reducing the amount of power that they sell to individual consumers. And that's really the key, I think, is rewarding those utilities for allowing people to use less.
Really, then, what you're talking about is sort of a two-prong approach. One is this bridge of efficiency, but ultimately it's reducing demand.
And, most definitely.
Yeah, and so given the scenario that Bill and I started the program with today, where we're talking about, I mean, we've all been dealing with buildings, and it's kind of the subject of what we're trying to get at here is understanding our building practices within living systems, and you hire that team that we discussed to design this building, how would you do it differently?
Well, I guess it's outlined in our book.
yeah, tell us about that book.
The way I like to describe that, I think, is using Einstein's definition of insanity. All right, you guys know that?
Yep.
Right, so it's doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So that's what we've been doing in many respects in the design industry and construction industry. We've been doing the same thing over and over for decades now, but now we're being asked to produce buildings that perform significantly better, say for energy. But you know, we're not necessarily going about it a different way.
So I
and
might say
if you really hope to get different results, you need to change the process by which you put it together.
Okay, so let's say, all right, we're going to do it differently. Let's use ground source heat pumps.
Right, and that's unfortunately where a lot of projects begin.
Why do they begin there?
Well, I think a lot of people just assume that the biggest impact on energy consumption in any building is going to be the HVAC system. And I think there's this kind of unwritten assumption that that's going to be the case.
So I don't know, maybe this is not a good time to raise this, but where should we start then, Marcus? If we're not starting with technology, where should we start?
Well, where we should start is by gaining a better understanding of how the building that you're working on uses energy, and then establishing performance goals for where you want to be when the project's done.
Okay, so how do you do that?
Right, so everybody knows the metric for automobile fuel efficiency, right? Miles per gallon. I would say well more than half of since John picked on engineers a little bit, and in a previous show I'll pick on architects a little bit. Well,
we're equal opportunity pickers here. So
you really are.
Yeah, well less than half of architects I don't think could even tell you what the metric is we use for measuring energy efficiency in buildings, 1,000 BTUs per square foot per year. So I think helping people to gain an understanding of what that means and then working with them using the ample amount of data that's out there to help them establish an overall performance goal is one of the first things you need to do. And in order to do that, you need to understand the differences between each building type that you're working on. Some buildings, the energy use is dominated by the building envelope. Some buildings, it's dominated by the lighting system. Some buildings, it's dominated by the equipment inside, like a computer data center or something like that. Other buildings, like a hospital, is dominated by the equipment and the ventilation loads within that building.
But
so you need to understand
the distribution of loads then.
I'm sorry?
This is the, I think what you're talking about then is the distribution of loads.
Correct. So you need to understand that distribution of loads in order to start to formulate strategies that make sense for that particular project.
Okay, so how do you do that?
You start with a goal.
Building.
You start with a goal, you break down the load, so you get a better understanding of that typical building type, and then you start focusing on where you want to place your effort technology-wise.
And so what kind of tools are there to help us do that?
Well, we do a lot of energy modeling, and I believe on an earlier show you explained what that was. It's computerized simulation of a building's energy performance. You put in all kinds of information into the computer. You basically build a little 3D model of the building into the computer. You assign characteristics to all the surfaces, the walls, the windows, so on and so forth. You put a heating and cooling system in there. You put lights in there. You put people in there, equipment, and then you apply a schedule, an operating schedule to all those things, and then it will simulate what the building's energy performance is. So you can start doing that kind of computer simulation very, very early on to try and guide decision-making.
Before the building's designed?
Well, you could even start before the building is certainly fully designed.
In fact, I'm just going to say, based on our experience, you really have to start before the building is designed to have a model so that the building can respond to something.
Right. That gets back to using it as a design decision-making tool. And unfortunately, you know, Leeds driven this to a certain extent. I'd say many models that are implemented on projects are currently done to validate performance at the very end, which is not the usefulness of an energy model. The usefulness of an energy model is to help you make relative decisions between options early in design. So you're right, Bill. You can start doing a model before you even have a design. Say you want to look at different options for massing of the building. Should it be a U-shape or an H-shape or a C-shape?
So tall or wide.
Right, or you know, how tall, how wide, what orientation should it face. These kind of early stage massing models, you can quickly and easily do energy models for to see if you can gain or garner some idea of what the relative difference between the different configurations would be.
How often are these used, Marcus? How often do people use energy models in buildings? What's the statistics? Do we know?
Oh, that's not a statistic I know. I mean, certainly the vast majority of LEED projects are coming up with a model.
I think
the stats there, you guys may have heard something more recent than me. We're up to about, 8% of the commercial market, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say of that 8%, maybe, in my opinion, 10 or 20% of folks are actually using it the correct way.
Mm-hmm.
And
there are states also that require energy modeling too, other than LEED, right, Marcus?
Yeah, like California, for example, requires energy modeling to show code compliance. But again, in many cases, and I'm not intimately familiar with the California market, so somebody may correct me there. But I believe it's as a code compliance tool, something that you typically do at the end of the project as well. I don't know that they require any early stage modeling.
So, Marcus, what it sounds like you're suggesting is almost a complete reversal of how we normally do things, where the scenario Bill and I opened with was talking about you design the building, then you figure out whether it works. What I think you're suggesting is you model what might work and then design the building accordingly.
The architect, in my opinion, needs to have the understanding that what they do for most building types will have as big or bigger an impact on the ultimate energy use of that building than what the mechanical engineer does.
Let me give you a stat that we used when I worked in Washington, D.C. We would do energy models for housing developers, and the model we would take a house and we would face it east, traditional colonial house, nothing fancy, nothing energy efficient about it other than the walls were insulated and high-performance windows. We would do an energy model, and then we would turn the building south in the energy model, and we would run the model again, and we would save 30% of the energy.
Sure.
with doing nothing with mechanical equipment, nothing expensive, just orienting the building. Does that work in larger buildings too, Marcus?
It can, but one of the things that I think a lot of folks get wrong, so we have this methodology in LEED now where you're supposed to take your base case building, the building you're comparing your project to, and you're supposed to rotate it four directions, and it depends not only on the orientation, but typically the distribution of glazing on those orientations.
Right.
So
I'm rotating the same configuration.
Right. So if I have a box, right, that has the same amount of glass on each orientation, right, it doesn't matter which way I turn it, right? Or even if I have something that's somewhat elongated rectilinearly along an east-west axis, even if I still have a fair amount of glass on the east and west orientations, I'm not going to see a huge difference.
So these buildings that all look the same in all four sides are actually energy hogs then?
That would be a component of producing an energy hog. I think that would be fair to say.
That's good.
That one of the keys to good orientation is not just, northern and southern exposure. It's especially minimizing western exposure. That's as critical or more critical than good north and south orientation.
Yeah, particularly west after the building's had all day to heat up.
Especially in buildings that need to be cooled a lot or, warm climates.
Marcus, you said something about the energy model is relative, and I think that's an important point that even professionals miss this. That I think most people, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think most professionals think, and of course the lay people think, that the energy model is a predictor of absolute energy use.
Right. So usually the way I address that issue is to talk about the fact that humans are notoriously poor at predicting anything in the future. And so I usually ask the audience when I do workshops, are any of you engineers and are you clairvoyant, right? Because if you are clairvoyant, I'd like you to come do my energy models, right? There are thousands and thousands of inputs that go into an energy model, and I guarantee you, you're not going to get every one of them right relative to how that building's going to operate once it's built.
So, Marcus, before
so it's not an absolute predictor.
Which of those inputs is probably the least predictable?
Probably the least predictable are the building schedules, how the building is actually operated.
When you say schedules, what do you mean?
Well, when do people arrive and when do they leave, and how many are there at a given hour, and how often are the lights on or off? When does the heating switch over to cooling and vice versa? And, you know, those kinds of operational issues are very difficult to predict.
So then what you're really trying to do is, when Bill and you were talking about what's relative, if you put the same schedules in what you're comparing to what you're designing, in other words, your benchmark and your design case, and the relative energy savings or energy consumption will be the same.
Yes, but the caveat that you put to that, and that's the purpose of modeling.
Sorry, Mark, you have to take a break. Sorry to cut you off there. Hold that thought, please. Don't let that one go. We'll see you all in just a few minutes.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at SkillsUSA.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey, y'all. This is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity, Thanks USA, does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking today with Marcus Scheffer all about energy. And Marcus, you were talking just before we left about the relative performance that is determined via energy modeling.
Well, that's really the purpose of energy modeling, is to enable you to make those relative comparisons. A former colleague of ours used to refer to it as it enables you to play what if on a scientific basis. So that's really the purpose behind it, and the key is making sure that your energy model that you're working on, obviously we don't know what the energy consumption of that building is going to be because we haven't built it. The key there is making sure that you're developing energy consumption values that are within the reasonable realm of possibilities, right? You don't want an energy model that's saying I'm going to be at 200,000 BTUs per square foot per year when it's more normal for, say, an office to be at 70,000 BTUs per square foot per year. So you want to make sure that your overall is within the reasonable realm of possibilities, and then what you do is you can make those kind of relative comparisons. So what if I added an extra 2 inches of insulation to the roof, or what if I changed out the windows to something more efficient, or what if I lowered my lighting power density or used a different HVAC system or whatever your relative comparison that you want to examine.
And that, so it's really, what's really fun about energy modeling, and you guys have a great story that I would like you to tell here, that it's not always about doing the most efficient thing or the most expensive thing. Sometimes what energy modeling proves is that the why we model is because we can actually save money through it.
Well, I think he's talking about the clear stories at DEP California.
Yes.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the great things about energy modeling is it gives you answers in many cases that may be counterintuitive, right? You may have, I know what's going to happen when I do that, in mind when you do the model, and you find out, well, it's not doing that. Well, then what you need to do is ask why it's not doing that and then try and figure it out. So in that particular example, we had just done a project where we had installed triple pane windows everywhere, and we had a lot of good rationale for doing that. It enabled us to eliminate a perimeter heating system, which saved us money, and actually on a net first cost basis, we're able to reduce the overall cost of the project by spending more on the windows. And
so the first pass energy model showed you that it was going to work.
Well, he's talking about a prior project where it actually did work.
So on the prior project, and it worked. We didn't have any problems with it. This subsequent project, so we assumed, that's the answer.
By the way, Marcus, just real quick, the order of magnitude. I think that modeled at about a 65% energy cost reduction.
Originally, yep.
Yep.
Okay. So next project we're working on, and we assume, we found an answer here, right? And we're going to apply that to the next project. And energy-wise, it seemed to be working okay. But we got a question from the owner of the building saying, well, we're spending a lot of money here on windows, guys. What we're thinking about doing was maybe using a more standard double pane window for the high clerestory windows, but keeping the triple pane windows down where people have proximity to them. And lo and behold, when we ran the model that way, energy consumption dropped. And what it was...
Well, with the less... performing windows.
With the lower performing windows in the clerestory. And what it was is we had a greater thermal loss, so we had higher heating energy and somewhat higher cooling energy. But because we had daylight sensing dimmers, the visible light transmittance of the lower performing thermally glass allowed more daylight in, which then reduce the amount of wattage going to light fixtures because we were dimming them to a greater degree more often.
I love that story. That's such a geek story, but I love it.
It is a really geeky story.
Thank
but you
very
what's
much.
Cool that it even gets better, right? Because if the lights are on less, this building was predominated by its cooling load, which means that with the lights on less, they're producing less heat, so there was a cumulative additional systemic...
Right, the amount of heat generated in the space, the windows were allowing more heat to enter the space, but that was more than offset by the fact that the lights were dimmed and putting less heat into the space.
Yeah, and what I love about this story also is that what it really shows is modeling's ability to look at how systems interact with each other, but even more, you're now able to focus on every possible way you can think of testing how to reduce loads. Because you can see by that example that, let's go ahead and put in ground source heat pumps, but all that's going to do is increase the efficiency of that heating and cooling system, but not necessarily reduce the demand of the building.
Yeah, let's make a really blunt example of that. These net zero buildings that are being built now, or at least by name, they're not achieving it with efficient equipment, are they, Marcus?
Well, one of the things I like to tell people about net zero, and it could be a long conversation here, but in my opinion, any moron with enough money can create a net zero energy building.
Well, let's talk about those morons and then how to do it unmoronic-like.
So, right, the moronic way to do it is you do whatever you do, and it's going to consume whatever energy it consumes, and then you just put a big enough PV array on the building to offset what you consume.
Yeah, we used to call those
solar panels. Spend a lot of money. And, certainly is not a replicable thing that we're going to be able to rely on to get us where we need to go.
So in other words, brother, I could make almost any building a net zero building now just by buying enough photovoltaics and slapping them on the roof.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the other thing that most net zero projects end up heading towards is they end up trying to be all electric. And we already talked about the fact that electricity in and of itself is extraordinary. The production of it is extraordinarily wasteful. But the reason that they go all electric a lot of times is because the calculation to net zero it is easy, right? You can figure out how many kilowatt hours you're going to consume and how many kilowatt hours you're going to produce, and you can do the net zero calculation easier. So let's take a scenario where instead of being all electric, let's say you want to be naturally gas heated. Certainly on a carbon basis, burning natural gas on your site is as good or better than any electric technology, depending upon where that electricity comes from, right? Because of the high carbon content in coal primarily for most of the country. Now, you know, Pacific Northwest, a lot of hydro, different story, but in most parts of the country, your electricity is what produces a lot of carbon. So if you're trying to do net zero energy with natural gas, right, so now I have a heating scenario that I need to offset. So I could buy a bunch more PVs and then on a BTU basis try and offset that. But that's actually going to probably be more BTUs because I'm going back to the source energy than if I went all electric.
Yeah.
So the other option you have is maybe solar thermal. But in order to get solar thermal in many climates to offset all of your heating needs, you're going to have to put a solar thermal system in that's probably 2 to 3 times what you need. Whereas a right-sized solar thermal system, maybe you can get 80% of your heating needs out of it. So, and you can do that combination, in my experience, much more cost-effectively than trying to achieve this net zero thing. And personally, I think near net zero in those kind of scenarios is more replicable and, you know, ultimately the direction we ought to head. I think personally net zero energy in many ways is a marketing term.
Well, it's a nice goal to have out there, but in reality you never can achieve net zero in the full sense of the term. Well, your energy is energy in your materials, there's energy in transportation to and from the building. I guess the only way that you would ever be truly zero is if you built it out of logs on the site that didn't burn any energy getting to and from it or to heat and cool it.
Or according to our definitions nowadays, if you put in a renewable energy system that produced way more energy than the building consumed to try and offset some of those energies that you were talking about.
Yeah, and the challenge that I keep seeing on net zero energy projects is really coming to alignment around the scope of what you're trying to neutralize. So you take into account the embodied energy in the materials that helped create and build that building. Do you take into account all the transportation to and from that building? Right? So it seems as if this energy sort of discussion certainly doesn't stop at the walls of the building.
It's ubiquitous.
So is sustainability really all about energy?
I think I'd probably have to agree with Bill put in that context. It's not necessarily all about energy, but energy is certainly a significant component
of
what it's going to take.
We don't want to downplay energy at all. We're not trying to do that, folks. It's just that we're so focused on climate change, we're so focused on carbon in the atmosphere, that's the driving ism at the moment. You know, we're all full of isms in our culture. We get the press captures one thing. I'm glad they've captured and are talking about it, but we're actually doing a disservice to all the things we need to be doing at the same time.
Right. Well, what I usually say, not is sustainability all about energy. I usually say it is all about energy, but that's kind of a reductionist worldview, Western worldview kind of way of looking at it, right? Everything is comprised of energy. So.
Well, at the atomic level.
Right. It's all about energy.
Well, the thing that really is intriguing about what you were talking about with net zero buildings is the degree to which you had to go way outside the building and its site to look at what the real impacts were based upon how energy is being generated in that place, hence a whole idea about nested larger systems within which we're working.
Most definitely.
I'd like when we come back after the break, I'd like to carry this forward a little bit in talking about the passive house and these buildings, these houses that are actually really approaching almost a very small percentage of energy use. Comes at it from a different angle. Just like to touch on that. So I think we're coming up to a break right now, and you're listening to Building Deeper Green. We'll be back in a moment.
Attention swimmers, get out of the that?
It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom, who's been swimming a lot with her kids, must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count. Minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk. Which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking today with our guest, Marcus Scheffer from the Seven Group. And right before the break, one of the discussions that led us into a more systemic thought about all of this was this notion of zero-energy buildings and zero-energy houses. And, Marcus, when you take a look at this approach of passive solar houses, what is it that is being accomplished and how?
Well, passive solar in and of itself is, I guess, a little different if you're looking at it residentially versus commercially, right? So in a residential scenario, it's quite possible to design a home that supplies the vast majority of its energy in many climate zones with the sun and only the sun. There are obviously mechanisms for allowing the sun to come in and excluding the sun when you don't want it, overhangs and changeable glazing if you want to go high tech. There are many ways to store solar energy for the times that you may need it when the sun isn't out. Passive solar heating, when it comes to a residential scenario, is certainly one of the things that would enable you to really, really approach net zero in a far more cost-effective manner than simply building a conventional house and putting a bunch of PVs on it.
So once again, you're focusing on trying to reduce the demand for energy in every way you can think of.
It's absolutely the key. I mean, we can't even go on produce or consuming energy at the level that we're consuming it right now, right? And somebody might say that, you know, is approaching sustainability, but, you know, we need to significantly reduce our overall demand. It's, you know, kind of the old argument between conservation and efficiency. Well, it's really both. So efficiency is doing what we need to do, you know, the cold beer and the warm shower, as efficiently as we possibly can. And conservation, in many cases, you know, a lot of people equate it with Jimmy Carter wearing a sweater by the fire, but it also is just plain common sense. You know, your grandparents that grew up during the Depression, right, they don't leave all their lights on in the house when they're in one room.
Yeah, I remember during the last energy, the Enron-induced energy crisis in California, it was pretty serious, but people were actually kind of surprised that they could turn off their jacuzzi once in a while.
Right, well, and the phenomenon when gas prices went up last year, right, and the millions and millions of miles people just drove less. They figured out a way to, you know, do what they needed to do without having to drive quite so much.
So, Marcus, what you're talking about then, I keep hearing this pattern of needing to change or transform how we think about this. So what are you? What is it that you're working on or trying to create in order to realize this kind of an outcome?
Well, we do a lot of work on individual building projects, both new green building projects and a lot of existing building projects as well. You know, I the key to me anyway, and you know, I think it takes a multitude of approaches to try and get at this subject. The key for me is almost really one conversation at a time, talking to individuals about what they can do, showing them that they can actually do most of this in a pretty cost-effective manner, if in some cases it's free even, if it's done really right and really well. So I see my role as somebody that's out there really trying to do what I can to show other people that there are considerable opportunities for saving energy, being more energy efficient, reducing energy, using more renewable sources of energy, and heading in that direction of trying to achieve a more sustainable energy future.
Well stated.
So what about existing buildings? You mentioned that.
Yeah, the approach is somewhat different, although there's an order you go in when you go into an existing building, just like there's kind of an order when you're working on a new building. You want to start with the building form itself. Well, in existing buildings, most of the time you're given the form, right? So that's a given. So in many cases, what you're doing is, what are the load reduction strategies that you can implement? And thinking about those first, and they're usually going to be things like more efficient lighting, maybe daylighting, if the building lends itself to it, better windows, things along those, more insulation perhaps, things along those lines that can reduce the building's loads. And you do that first. The thing that you don't want to do is you don't want to put in a brand new HVAC system and then let's go reduce the loads. Because now what I've done is I put in a system that's oversized for the need. It potentially could short cycle. It's going to use more energy. It's going to operate for more hours at lower efficiency than a right size system.
So like with an existing building, what kind of, let's say a building built in the 70s or 80s that's ready to be retrofitted. Let's say you put in certainly much better windows and you reduce infiltration and maybe even some insulation. What kind of system size reduction can you approach? I know this is a generality, Marcus, but
that's a huge generality. I'd say it's probably a bit less than new construction. So it depends on the project. You could approach 30-40% size reduction.
That 30-40% basically is what, if every building does that, that's what I think Ed Masri is saying that we need to do to create, to reduce the threshold of climate change.
Most definitely.
So, Marcus, we have maybe a minute or so left with you today. And there's another thing that really didn't get talked about, but I know you're really keen on it. And could you just touch a little bit on impacts of daylighting on our buildings and energy consumption?
Daylighting is generally not done too well, and I assume we're primarily talking about new construction. Just because you have a bunch of windows doesn't mean you have good daylight. There's an art and a science to analyzing good daylighting performance. Daylight by far gives us the best light to see under. We, as a species, evolved under it. We see better under it. It's high-quality light. There are studies that show if you work or live in a building that has higher quality light, you actually need fewer foot candles. So the focus on lighting design tends to be on quantity, which one could argue is the focus of somewhat of our culture in general. But that is really just one isolated metric of visual acuity. And visual acuity is our ability to see, and it's far more than just quantity of light. It's distribution, it's uniformity. I'm sitting in an office right now that's completely daylit. I probably have about 15 foot candles on my desk. I can see perfectly fine. But the lighting design guidelines say I need 50. And I'm reading my notes here pretty clearly. So Good day lighting design is a significant way to reduce energy consumption in buildings, and it's one of the first places any commercial building should start.
And it, of course, creates higher levels of that indoor environmental quality or human habitat component that also connects back out to the habitat outside of our buildings. So really, then, daylighting is a means by which to address several of these key subsystems we're talking about.
Yeah, living systems, right, John?
It's a living system issue. So, Marcus,
that's
we want
to
thank
think
you.
About it, so on and so on and so on.
And so, well, Marcus, thank you very much. It really brought a lot of great information to us today. I appreciate you taking
it. It was great to be with you guys.
See you, Marcus.
Yeah.
So the whole interconnection thing comes up so much, you know, when they're talking to Jerry and Keith and Michael Ogden about water, and I mean Jerry and Keith about living systems, Marcus about energy. It's all interrelated. You can't separate them into silos, even though we do.
Now, you know what? I just want to throw something out there. Maybe it's a little late to do this, but depending on what scale you're working on, maybe it is all about energy, right? Because you're talking about the subatomic scale, right? Of course.
Well, it's all so what? Wow, that
I want to go
really
the other
heavy,
way.
Really heavy, John. Because let's go there. Because energy, you know, we talk about the energy in a room, or the energy of a person, or the energy of a corporation, and just the kind of the buzz. Well, that's kind of a level of consciousness, and we're going to be talking about that in a few episodes as well.
And see, that's, to me, what's really exciting about this, because we keep seeing this pattern of interactions and interrelationships between systems. How can we become more conscious of those in ways that we can clearly engage them using a different mindset than the mindset that got us here?
So how can we become more energized about them is another way of saying it.
Ah, so that, too, is working at a different scale. In fact, Dana Meadows, who we'll talk about at one of these episodes, she posited that one could become instantly operating using a different consciousness by being aware of it. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're trying to get at here is that it does sort of, not sort of, it is a different consciousness that will be required of all of us to really achieve these goals we're talking about. Hence,
so,
every show, right?
Start it off, John.
Right, by saying, to do different things, we need to do things differently.
And to do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And to think about them differently, we need to be different.
Be energized about them differently.
So we'll see everybody next week. Thanks for joining us. So long, week.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.